This passage, or this section of the passage, is a warning. And as I said, it's meant to emphasize the things we've already read. Now, I'm going to throw it out to you as people who read the Bible. What is the general warning, though, in this passage? As you read through this, what is Paul wanting to make us aware of, and what is Paul wanting us to avoid? Don't be like the Gentiles. Very good. That's plain and simple. Exactly what it is. As I said, it's not that complex, at least on the surface. It's a simple warning. It's something that's harder to put into practice, as I think we'll see. But as I was reading this, at least, through the course of this week, as I said, it's a fairly straightforward warning. On the other hand, when you think about the context of the book of Ephesians, and we've gone on and on and on about how Ephesus is the good church, does it not seem a little strange that Paul has to be warning them about being like the Gentiles? It would seem that they've already done that, does it not? So how might you explain this to yourselves, at least, if you're going through this passage? On the one hand, we have what we said is the good church. It's the church that really doesn't have warnings about the things that they're doing. But on the other hand, you've got this warning right here. Don't be like people in the world. Something that they already seem to be doing and excelling at. How do you reconcile that?
Because they're sinners, and they'll go back to doing what they were doing.
All right, very good. Anybody else?
I think when I read that, and he's telling don't be like the Gentiles, I remember that sometimes we tend to think that we're Gentiles because we're not ethnic Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Paul considers, you know, the Christians, Gentile or not, as Jewish within the church, and he's and people who aren't in the church are the Gentiles, and that's what it comes to mind with.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, Paul has seen Gentilism in his own people, or in the way they acted. So, any other thoughts? I thought I saw another hand. Ben.
He says on the futility of their minds,
mm-hmm.
thinking that we tend to, instead of depending on God, we tend to want to do things our way.
Depend on ourselves.
Solve problems.
Yeah, I'm glad you actually mentioned that word. And, go ahead, Helen, first. Yeah, harden. That's another word we're going to look at here a little later on. Vernon.
Well, I think oftentimes we like to think that we're so much different from all the others in the Old Testament. But the one thing that's consistent throughout the Old Testament is they forget.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we tend to forget. And I think he's saying,
don't forget. Oh, that's it. You guys have all basically hit on it. And this should stand out in our minds, especially, again, this is one way her context helps us. And that is, if the church at Ephesus needs to be reminded of this and needs to be warned about this danger, then there's no church that doesn't need it. I mean, everybody needs to call this to mind, and everybody needs to be aware of that they're not above this danger. They're not free from the temptation to regress, as R.C. mentioned. And that's, again, something that we would all acknowledge, but it's easier said than done. But, again, if it's a danger to Ephesus, it's a danger to everybody. And so, turn with me, if you will, to Galatians chapter 5, very well-known passage. But what we're seeing here, and what we're seeing Paul warn this church the way that he does, is connected with what R.C. said from the beginning, which is, although on the one hand, as Christians, we make progress, we're never totally free, at least in this lifetime, of the danger of regressing, or the danger of falling back into old sins. If I can find Galatians, we'll look at that, though. It's behind Ephesus, not before. Galatians chapter 5, and I'll do the reading here, though. And I know there's nothing worse than someone put you on the spot when you're not prepared. But I'm going to look at verse 7 and then verses 13 through 17. Verse 7 in Galatians 5. You were running well. And again, I'll give you a little more context. Galatia is a church that needs to hear this. They had Ephesus was doing well. Galatians did not do well when Paul had to write to them. But you were running well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth? And then skipping ahead to verse 13. For you were called to freedom, brothers. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, watch out that you are not consumed by one another. But I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit, and the desires of the Spirit are against the flesh. For these are opposed to each other, to keep you from doing the things you want to do. And so while, as Christians, there's a sense in which we have been enlightened. God has woken us up from the stupor that every other person, people who are not Christians, are still slumbering in. But just because we've been wakened up doesn't mean we can't roll back and decide we want to go to sleep again. Each of us faces that temptation every morning. But it's a very similar temptation. It's easier, again, to close our eyes, roll back over at certain points. And so that's what Paul wants them to be aware of, that just because you've been waking up, just because you've seen Christ at work in your life, doesn't mean that you can let your guard down. And this has been a big problem throughout the whole history of the church. Many, many different Christians, many, many different churches have had to face this. In fact, every church, I think, has to face it, and every Christian has to face it at some point or another. And that's the temptation to let our guard down, to fall into a false sense of security. And there's even denominations or not, but there's strains of thought within Christianity that try to, turn this into a doctrine even, where that, you know, believe that you can actually get past the point of sinning anymore. You have your sort of levels of theology. I remember a professor of mine at RTS, Dr. Rod Culbertson, he had not gone to a Reformed seminary, or a Reformed seminary, but talking about hearing, I think it was a guest lecture at a class he was in, and the guy came in and was talking about sanctification, and the guy actually said that he hadn't consciously sinned in over 20 years. And my professor Rod leaned over to the guy he was sitting with, and he says, "I think he just did." But there's... As Christians, it's the old problem of getting your regeneration and sanctification confused. You know, regeneration is being wakened up, but sanctification is maybe even an oversimplification, but the getting out of bed and doing something. You know, you're not going to accomplish anything unless you actually get out of the bed. No matter, you can sit up and stay awake for a long time, but again, you have to get up and do something. And so, we must be aware of the danger, though, of simply having our eyes open does not mean that we're safe, and that, I mean, we're going to be safe. I thought I saw a hand go up. But this false sense of security that Paul is wanting to warn the church at Ephesus about. It's doing well, but don't rest on your laurels. Don't sit back and think that you're doing as well as you can, but don't think that you can't do better, but also don't think that you can't do worse, or that you can't slip back and that you can't regress. And the major reason why, it's very interesting when you look at this. As I said, I'll turn back here to Ephesus, or Ephesians rather. The things we see here, Paul starts talking about the way people in the world think. And you mentioned the word futility, Ben. Well, how would you define that word? It's not a word we use every day. It's a word that we can gloss over in a passage like this, and we can get the general meaning, but In some ways, though, if we're specifically asked to define it, I'm not sure. You ever have that happen? You can be reading through a book, and you can pass over a word, and you're not sure of the meaning, but you know the general because of the context and everything. But again, if you were asked to define the word, you'd be a little bit hard pressed to do that. That's how I found futility, at least, even reading this. How would you define futility, Glenn?
I think of futility as being unreasonable, untrue, foolish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're on that. Those are, you're right. I think those are all three included in that definition. That's very good, Ben.
I think it's effort that doesn't accomplish anything.
That's very good too. It's
useless.
That's actually a word that's in the dictionary. It's listed under, and that's one of the scriptural where I did actually do a little translating for this, and all of those things that you guys mentioned are useless. A useless endeavor, something that you're putting effort into something, but it's a point, it'd be like me going outside and flapping my wings thinking I was going to fly. But that's the same way that people there's a temptation to, there's a danger in me in trying to sound high and mighty as opposed to people who are just out walking on the streets today and not in a church. That's not how I mean, but the very basic truth is that people in the world have their thoughts are pointless. They put it very simple. They're not going to accomplish. They have thoughts. They have plans, but they're not going to accomplish anything. They're as pointless again as me going out and thinking I can fly by flapping my arms up and down. And that's not, again, to sound high and mighty, because as you'll hear, and as you'll hear me acknowledge right now, the only reason I'm not doing that is because of the presence of Jesus Christ. But what's more, though, is, as Paul talks about here, we're not above that yet in this lifetime. And going back to what we talked about at the beginning, is we're not above futile thoughts. We're not above trying to enter into useless endeavors or trying to serve ourselves in that way. And so the danger I think that Paul is trying to make the Ephesians aware of, and the danger that I think we all must really acknowledge, it's a thing that if we acknowledge, I think goes a long way to safeguarding a church. But that is the greatest danger facing any church, any faithful church, facing Covenant of Grace today, is not from the world, and it's not from non-Christians. The greatest danger facing any church is Christians or people who claim to be Christians who think and act like worldly people, people who walk and talk as people in the world do, people who think as people in the world do. The greatest danger to any church comes from within. It's not from without. Truth is, Barack Obama can't do any. I mean, even with the full powers of government, he can do virtually nothing to break up or split up this church. I mean, he may be able to do that, but at least to hurt anyone in this church spiritually, he has virtually no power to do that. Patrick Gretzinger, on the other hand, I could probably within the next 30 seconds, start a hullabaloo in this church, take probably two or three sentences, but it's funny to think that, and I don't hope I'm not giving anyone any ideas, but it's true. I have 1,000 times more potential to damage this church than does any politician or does any professor. Which one's alive, Hitchens or Dawkins? Which one died? Hitchens, Richard Dawkins does, or anyone we disagree with. I'm the one who's the greatest danger to this church, but it's not simply me, each one of us here. Yeah, R.C.
Sometimes, though, when we have a leader who is friendly to us, or seemingly friendly, we tend to relax. Nothing brings out the martyrs, or nothing brings out the glory of God like the blood of martyrs. So, somebody that's after your church, it seems to bond us.
It's that's again this false sense of security. The persecution has never been a threat to the church. I mean, it's been a threat to us physically, and people have lost their lives because of it, but it's never, ever come close to stamping it out. It's like, I remember, the greatest dangers to the church have always come from within. We've been our own worst enemy, and the reason the church has retreated has been because of the people who were in there, not the people who were without. I remember I worked one summer at the county highway department. I'm going to use this to try to illustrate, you know, what outside persecution does to a church. And there was, they have these things called snow trucks up in Indiana, salt trucks that you put salt in, they put on the roads for when it snows and when it ices. And they have these things on the back that distribute, gets really, really rusted. And so I had to scrape one of these off one day and repaint it this bright yellow. And while I was doing that, I tipped over the whole paint can. And wanting to try to cover up my, mistake, I took the hose, no one else was around, they were all out doing other stuff, and tried to spray it away, which by the time I was done, half this gravel parking lot was a pale yellow. But all that's to say that it's not unlike what happens with the church in persecution. The more they try to spray it, the more they try to disperse it, they really just spread it out. That's what happens multiple times in the New Testament. It just makes it go out. And so that's not, you know, we like to, not for bad reasons, but we like to talk about the outside forces that we think we're going to have to grapple with. But those, if anything, will help us. And they're not things that we should be afraid of. The things we have to be afraid of are the forces that are at work inside the church, and particularly, first and foremost, our own hearts. Again, we are the biggest danger to the church as it is today. Each one of us has the power. We talked about this in the leadership class, if you were there, as elders. You know, an elder can't save a church on his own, but he can sure do a lot to bring it down. But it's not just restricted. He has more opportunities to do it, but anybody in the church can do it. And so that brings us to what the problem is. And the problem is, again, most of the things in this passage that we're looking at, I always do this, are fairly simple and straightforward. But again, they're harder to put into practice, and sometimes, well, anyway, the principal warning, though, and the principal way that we can do damage and harm to the church, as we've just established, is by living and acting like people in the world. And I think this can be very simply down to the idea of selfishness. That's what motivates people in the world. And there's a lot of ways, tremendous number of ways that manifests itself. But that's the problem, plain and simple. And so there's the sense in that every problem a church ever encounters, especially every dispute and every split, is the result of people acting like people in the world, acting like worldly people. People in the world act like they do because they're selfish. I remember R.C. Sproul teaching once on, I think it was one of his Logic series. He was talking about dissecting arguments. And he said anytime you have a dispute or a difference of anytime you have a dispute between two people, there's actually three ways of explaining it. They say, use me and someone else for an example. It can be either I'm wrong and the other person is right, the other person is wrong and I'm right, or we're both wrong. You can't both be right. And so that's what it boils down to, though, disputes in the church, is either using the same thinking, either I'm acting like a worldly person and the people I'm coming up against are acting like Christians, or I'm acting like a Christian and they're worldly, or we're both acting like worldly people. And sadly, even when you start with one part, usually, at least when you start with one party acting like at least a Christian, it's hard to keep it from degenerating into a conflict between two worldly people. We've talked about this in the last couple of weeks, but it's again something that's, I guess in some ways for the sake of any church, you can't talk about enough. But this concept of selfishness, It's a simple thing to understand. I don't think I need to define that to anybody here, and I don't think there's anyone here who wouldn't say that they have a problem with it. The Bible says we do, but I don't think we need the Bible to tell us that in some ways. On the other hand, though, it's something that's incredibly hard to overcome, is it not? It's something that we always struggle with, and again, it goes back to this battle between the spirit and the flesh that we read about back in Galatians. And Paul realizes this too. He realizes that, or I think that's what he realizes at least, is that, and why he wants to keep the Galatians aware of this problem, is that, you know, on the one hand, it's something everyone knows is there, but it's not something that scares us. I don't think. I can put this word up here, and it's, you know, I think everyone would acknowledge that they have to struggle with it, and I think everyone acknowledges that it's a flaw that we all have, but I don't think we look at it as something that's deadly and something that's dangerous, or most of us don't. Or even if we have at one point in our lives, we again are tempted to think we've gotten over it, or we've gotten over the worst of it, that some of it still lingers with me a little bit in some way, shape, or form, but I'm certainly not as bad as I used to be. But again, it's that hidden weight that can at any point, you know, it's like that anchor. It gets thrown overboard, it's going to pull you down under. Again, it's there, and it's something that we have to keep tabs on. And that's what Paul wants us to do. And the main way he wants to do it is by getting us to understand it better, to getting us to understand that it's not quite as simple a thing as we think. Now, it's not unlike somebody would say skin cancer or something like that. Now, to my understanding, that type of cancer, it just seems like a little discoloration or disfiguration when it first shows up. And it's not something that's going to scare you, at least at the beginning, because it's so small and it seems you can get your head around it. And it's the way it is with selfishness. We think we understand it and therefore we're not afraid of it. That's the way it works with most things. We're scared of things we don't understand. And what Paul's trying to say is you don't understand this as well as you think you do. And like a doctor with cancer, he's going to try to say, no, this is, you need to do something about this or it's going to get much, much worse. And he's going to explain what's actually going on. Paul also wants to explain to the church at Ephesus why this thing that seems so simple is so dangerous. And so he begins to dissect it. He begins to break it down. That's what you see in these opening verses. And what you see in Paul's explanation of it, and you see it there in the first couple of verses, no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds. And then he begins to get into the explanation. They are darkened in their understanding and alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardness of their hearts. Actually, the whole explanation is in verse 18 there. But what Paul does here is very simple, and it's not unlike what a doctor would do. He starts with the symptoms. And the symptoms in this case are blindness / ignorance. Then he goes back to what the real or the root of the problem is. And that is hardness of the heart. Now, I'd say there's a temptation to say that these two things are equal standing beside each other. My contention is that the hardness of the heart is what actually leads to the ignorance and the blindness. And the reason I do that, if you're a good exegete, and I don't like the way the ESV translates here, but you see in verse 18 that there's a due to the heart. A better translation of that is probably because. So he's saying that one happens because of the other. The blindness and the ignorance happen because of the hardness of the heart. They're not two things. I mean, we're inclined to think that our problem is that people can't see. Well, no, the reason people can't see is because their hearts are hardened first. There's a progression that's happening here. So again, this idea of selfishness and the actions that come about as a result of it has at its root something greater. It's not unlike, say, food poisoning. You know, if you have food poisoning, you're going to be nauseated, you get a headache, fever maybe, something like that. But those things are just the symptoms. The real problem is the bad stuff that you've ingested. R.C.
Well, hardening our hearts leads to
their heart over injustice.
Absolutely. It's absolutely the case, and that's what the great illustration is here. The problem is, how do our hearts get unhardened? And bigger question, can we, even as Christians... Oh, Phil, do you have a...
I was just thinking along those lines. Running back to when we first started in Ephesians, I'm bad my trespasses and sins. And my heart is hardened carnally to what I am, what I want, that total depravity of man, human family, until the Holy Spirit gives me a new heart. I can't. Now that He gives me a new heart, my question is, can I fall into this category that we're studying this morning? I've got that heart of Christ.
And that's a great, thank you, that's a better segue than what I even had in here to what you're saying. And the answer, I believe, is yes, you can. And the reason why is that the hard heart is not the actual reason for the blindness or the ignorance. It's not as if I harden my heart and then I start gouging out my eyes. That's not the way. The hard heart is not, it's, it may sound a little strange, and I'll slow down even here if anyone wants, but the hard heart is actually not the reason for the blindness. The heart, it's the cause of it, but it's God who is ultimately the cause of the blindness because of the hard heart. And so, even when our heart has been softened at times, I think there are times when we, I don't want to say harden it again, but when we start to lose enthusiasm, that He may throw us back into the blindness, or at least cloud us a little bit. Turn, if you will, Romans, maybe a little bit hard to understand, so I want to let Scripture do most of the talking here. But very clearly, what we're talking about, or very simply, hopefully simply, is that when people in the world harden their hearts to God, to the truth, God is the one who then blinds them. He's the one who takes away their vision. He's the one who makes them ignorant and makes their thinking futile. He's the one who does that. Romans 1, and I'll do the reading here today. Romans 1, we'll start at verse 24, and we'll maybe go to the end of the chapter. But Romans 1, starting with verse 24. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, then, this is why He did it, or this is what happened. God's the one who does this. God gave them up to dishonorable passions. For their women, I'll skip ahead a little bit. I'll skip ahead to 28. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, He gave them up to a debased mind, to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. And in case you think that the things that separate us from the world are purely the things that people do on the outside, the things that people do on Saturday nights in bars, that's not the case. We know that Christians struggle with covetousness and envy and the like, and that in some ways, we talked about this at, I think it was our elders' informal meeting a couple weeks ago, about how in some ways, it's the people who are unregenerate in the church who are harder to get to. You can bring a person out carousing on a Saturday night under conviction much more easily than you can a legalist. And not much more easily, it's easier to convict a person who's struggling with lust than it is a person struggling with envy or covetousness. Let me go on here. There are gossips. Not a problem the church is above. Slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful. I mean, he's describing the Jewish church here. And the Jewish church on the outside, not Jewish church, but the Jews at the time of Christ and leading up to the time of Christ, were outwardly the most moral people in the Roman Empire. And yet they suffered from all of these things. Inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. You have to be that way to put Christ to death. Though they know God's decree, those who practice such things deserve to die. They not only do them, but they give approval to those who practice them. And so, you see, these are things that many people in the world that afflict them and that they do, but it comes as a result of God turning them over to their own blindness. He says, you're going to act like you're blind, then I'm going to make you blind. And that's what it gets down to with hardness of heart. And I forget which person mentioned this, but it's the idea of basically lying to yourself about being confronted with the truth of God and saying, I'm not going to believe it no matter how true it is. It would be like me looking at this whiteboard and I'm saying, look, this whiteboard is white. No, it's black. Well, no, it's clearly white. And me say, no, it's black. I can see it's white, but I can say it's black. And I can say, keep saying, you know, I have that power as a man. But that's exactly how it is with the truth of God and people in the world, and sadly sometimes people in the church. It's not that we don't know. It's that we refuse to acknowledge. That was the Pharisees' problem. R.C.
The problem is not when it's completely black or white. It's, well, is it really cream-colored or is it white?
Yeah.
And we fight the nuance around God's words.
Yeah, we're usually not so bold as to come out and say that it's... You're right. We usually do that by degrees. We'll say, well, you know, it's sort of black, it's sort of white, but you got some black spots, and you definitely got writing, so you can't say it's... I mean, we'll be a little more clever than that, but it's not... But it's... Doing that is tantamount to saying it's black, or tantamount to, you know... When I say, this is white, you know what I mean. And you can try to nuance it all you want, but I mean, you know the general idea of what I'm trying to convey, and that's how it is. The truth has been revealed to everyone, and yet that's what this hardening of the heart is. It's this willful rejection. It's this refusal to accept. And what God does is say, all right, if you're not going to acknowledge that's white, then I'll really make it look black to you. I'm going to take away your vision. Daphne.
And, you know, I'll tell them, well, it's Nathan, I'll just go ahead and say it. You know, if you do this, if you get closer, it's going to hurt, you're going to get hit in the face. It's, you know, you warn them, but you can tell they're tiptoeing up, seeing how close. And there's a point where you realize the best teaching, the only way this child is going to learn is if you let him, you give him over to exactly what he wants to do. And so he does get hit in the face, and he does
learn. And that's what happens with Christians sometimes. There's a difference. God will sometimes turn us over. When your heart is hardened, you're not going to feel that the pan is hot. You're just going to keep holding your hand there until it catches fire, burns up, and eventually kills you. That's what, you're dead to it. But when your heart is alive, and you still want to try to touch the pan, then it has the opposite effect. You realize... It drives you back to God. You realize, oh, this is what he meant all along. And God gives you the warnings leading up to it. And then finally, sometimes they'll be like, all right, do it. And that's, you know, that happens. The best example is David, with Bathsheba. David's sin with Bathsheba is not simply what he did with Bathsheba. It had a long leading up. Remember, and it's not, you know, he's first out on the rooftop where he shouldn't have been. But even about that, he shouldn't have been in Jerusalem at the time. He should have been out with the army. The whole rest of the army was out. It was the duty of the king to be leading the army, but for whatever reason, he decided that year he wasn't going to go. And so you see God sort of pulling away the safeties and finally turns him over to sin. But when he's convicted, he realizes it. He's not hardened like Saul is. Saul goes from bad thing to bad thing to worse thing to worse thing to worse thing. He never comes under conviction. Only when he desperately wants help, but even then, that's only for his own selfish purposes. David, however, comes under conviction, and that's what happens. That's how the blindness sort of works. It works differently in Christians and non-Christians. The non-Christian is... Vernon.
I was just going to say the same thing. Sometimes God does that on his own. He allows through circumstances or whatever he may allow to happen to you as a result of willful disobedience. But sometimes through the process of his ordained process in Matthew 18 about the discipline, he uses other people around you to try and bring you to an awareness of the sin. And not with necessarily punishment, but trying to get you to acknowledge the fact that you are drifting.
Oh, that's the thing. It's when he rebukes us or blinds us, it's not punishment. It's meant to restore us. Now, it's punishment when the worldly man holds his hand in the fire and won't pull it out and refuse. That's punishment. It works differently, though, when your heart has been softened. You know, when you... seems strange, but Christians, part of the reason why Christians, I think, feel more pain in the world than people, or feel more pain than people in the world do. Phil, were you...
One of the measures that I think that over the years in churches has served is that you can easily, and we've been praying for some specific situations in God's kingdom, one of the things you can easily measure why things are going the way they're going is a phrase that I use is usually the heart of the matter is a matter of the heart. What's the chief end of man? The chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. When we live our lives in such a way that our heart is taking us away from giving God glory, then we got our problems, and it's centered on self. It's not centered on everything that we do.
Did you? It's almost like you stole my lesson plan, Phil. No. I'm glad you said it, because no, not at all. Don't get me wrong. It's exactly what the end purpose here, I think, is of Paul. I had an idea that the heart is not unlike a tunnel. It can only go. You can only go one way or the other in a tunnel. You can either go forward or back. You can't go side to side. You can't go up or down. So when I say this, I mean that the heart can only go towards God, or it can only go towards self. And as you're talking about, Phil, when it goes to God, it manifests itself in love. On the other hand, it is hardened when it turns back to self. It's that simple. I mean, man will cover this hardness in as many things as he can. I mean, he'll call this love. He'll try to justify his selfishness by cloaking it in love. He'll even try to cloak it in the word God. Say, I'm doing this for God. But that's why we have that's why the Bible doesn't simply state these things, as a difference between love and self. It says, no, there's... You can call it love, or you can call it service to God, but this is what real service to God looks like. And you go back to the passage like we looked at in Galatians, the fruit of the Spirit. If the fruit of the Spirit is, that's how it even works in church discipline, as Vernon was talking about. There's a spirit that's supposed to be done in, and it's for the reclamation of the person. It's not punitive. It's not punishing for the sake of punishment. And that's how we're supposed to do all things. That's how... a dispute or a difference of opinion in the mind of two genuine Christians should not lead to a splitting of a church. They should be able to work through it. They should be able to recognize whether this is a cross to die or a hill to die on or whether it's not. And even if they agree that they have to part ways, then they do so amicably. If they especially believe that, the intangibles are in place or that they're both genuine Christians, and I may have a difference of opinion with my brother, but if I believe he's a true brother, then I'm not going to hate him in spite of that difference. I'm not going to let that at least come away. And even though we may have to part way in some certain area, that's not going to divide the greater thing uniting us that we talked about earlier in this passage, which is, the Trinity connecting, or is what ultimately binds us together, the working of each person in the Trinity in our lives.
You don't take the rest of the
That's a big, that's a very, that's an absolute truth, and it's something that people just don't see most of the time. Debbie,
It's kind of, we're talking about two different hearts here, right? The unregenerate.
I'm talking about a hard one and a soft one, yeah.
No, I'm talking about lost and saved.
Mm-hmm.
Christian, non-Christian. Just like he's talking about the discipline. The discipline can reveal an unregenerate heart.
Yeah.
And the division in the church can reveal an unregenerate heart that's causing the trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Back and forth, you know, we're talking about hardening.
Uh-huh.
But if it's dead, it's not going to see any of this if it's an unregenerate heart.
That's a point that we skipped over here. I'm glad you actually brought it back, and it ties into with evangelism a little bit. You know, it's when we recognize that the blindness or the ignorance is not the ultimate problem, but that it's the hardness of the heart, and we realize that getting someone to come to Christ or even correct someone in the course of discipline isn't a matter of simply explaining the error or doing a better job of explaining the gospel or being a more effective evangelist, finding what's the right angle to hit this person with. And that's not that those things are completely invalid, but that's not the key to converting someone or to correcting someone when it comes to discipline. It's a matter of, it's always a heart issue. And so that's where we have to start. Now, God will use those other things, if it's His will, to correct the blindness. But the blindness only goes away when the heart is softened. And even then, sometimes, like I said, God will correct His own by, you know, turning them over to their sin for a season. And that's what discipline is in a way, too. It talks, the Scripture talks about, turn him over to the devil. Maybe that will be what finally corrects him. And sometimes that's necessary too. But again, it's a heart issue ultimately. And it's this desire either to accept what God says or to reject what you know to be true. Which is again, you know, the very definition of futility. Go ahead, Bernie.
But I think maybe David's question is that I think it is a way to possibly confuse people. Hardness mm-hmm. and with unregenerate. They're not always equivalent. You can have a regenerate heart that is slightly harder because of
it. And that's not what I'm talking about. Yeah, I'm sorry, I probably confused it a little from the get-go. But when I'm talking about hardness here, I am talking about an unregenerate heart. And that's what I think Paul is talking about here too, when he talks about the callous being over the heart. Only God can take that away. And so I probably should have clarified that a little better at the beginning, but I'm using hardness for unregenerate in this passage. And then that's, you know, hard versus soft. That's what I meant to say. So is that a little clearer? No, I'm sorry about that. So live and learn on that one. But as we get to come close to concluding here, turn, if you will, we're going to look a little bit more at this hardness. Ephesians, and just this is more an sort of an exclamation point. Mark chapter 3. Starting at the first verse, but just another illustration of it using the Philistines, or not the Philistines, the Pharisees. And showing how, you know, this is the very definition of futility here, but it's at the same time something that we have to recognize as Christians we're not above. But here, all this, sword of the man with the withered hand. Here, Mark 3:1. Again, he entered the synagogue, and a man was there with a withered hand. And they watched Jesus to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man with the withered hand, come here. And he said to them, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm? So you see, Jesus is already setting the stage here. It's not a matter of breaking the Sabbath law or keeping the law. It's a matter of being able to recognize good or harm. That's what the ultimate difference is, and he's asking them to look for. Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm? To save life or to kill? But they were silent. And he looked around at them with anger, grieved at the hardness of heart, at their hardness of heart, and said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went on and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. This is what futility is. This is what futile thinking is. It's an inability to recognize good when it happens. The Pharisees, I mean, first of all, they had no compassion. But they couldn't see that something very good had happened to this man. They absolutely refused to acknowledge. They couldn't see it. They couldn't feel. You know, there is a sense of, in this, the word heart does not simply refer to the feelings, but it includes the feelings, it includes the whole substance of a Christian's being, the mind, the will, the heart, all of it. But they, in their hearts, they couldn't see it. Moreover, they had no appreciation for what Jesus had done. A hand's hand had been completely restored. That should have blown their minds away. Even a non-Christian in that moment should have been able to acknowledge that was something incredible. Moreover, that was something good. And yet, they absolutely refused to see it as such. And yet, at the same time, the thing, again, that we have to be worried about is that we have God do good things for us throughout the course of our lives, and we may not be like the Pharisees and not acknowledge it at all, but we can very quickly forget, and we can very quickly return to questioning God. And so, it comes again, though, back to this twofold nature of the heart. It's either going to look toward God, or it's either going to look back toward itself. And the Pharisees, because they had completely let themselves become completely absorbed with self, were unable to see it. You know, futility, blindness, God had already seemed to have turned them over at this point. Other people would come under conviction and would be moved by the things they saw. But it wasn't so with the Pharisees. And let's conclude here. We're going to very familiar passage, but one I hadn't read in a while when I was going through this. 1 John chapter 4. We're going to be looking at verses 7 through 12. First John chapter 4, verse 7. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God, and whoever loves has been born of God and knows God. Anyone who does not love does not know God, because God is love. And in this, the love of God was made manifest among us, that God sent his only Son into the world so that we might live through him. In this is love, not that we have loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God. If we love one another, God abides in us, and his love is perfected in us. And perhaps we can pick this up a little bit next week, but what does this passage say about people who won't love each other? Or especially a Christian who will not love his brother, or who is at least very stingy in his love for his brother? They're living for themselves. That's, again, the eyes are focused backwards. Glenn, what did you say?
They don't know God.
That's it. And they could have Calvin Institutes memorized, and there are people who are almost like that, but do so, again, it's this idea of cloaking self in something else. And so it's not simply a matter of the head knowledge. Phil, what were you going to say?
We can so easily recognize that problem in others than ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's a spiritual.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, the first concern has to be with, you know, in a strange way, strange for me to go out with a sentence like this, but, you know, the focus has to be on yourself, but sort of in the negative way, is what, you know, what do my feelings tell me, or what do my actions, feelings, thoughts tell me about myself and tell me about the condition of my heart? And you know, again, people have done many evil and awful things over the course of the years, through the centuries, in the name of God and in the name of love. People call their self, you know, so many different kinds of selfishness love. You just have to go onto a college campus to see that. You see it within 30 seconds, but you see all the different things they try to cover it in. And they'll try to accuse us of being unloving in return, but the church is not above it. And the degree to which we struggle with this, and going back to the man with the withered hand, just a good idea to leave you with. The degree, or our reaction to the blessings that others receive, goes a long way to telling us where our own hearts are. You know, we see God do something awesome like Jesus does, but then that's the proper use of that word there. You know, restoring the man's hand. But so often when we see other people, that happen to other people, our own thought is, well, why didn't that happen to me, or why hasn't that happened to me yet? And so that's, again, it doesn't mean that your heart is completely hardened, but it does mean that you need to be checking yourself and going back to God, confessing and praying that He would help you with that. It's like Vernon said too, God's going to give you a lot of warning before you actually, or Daphne said too with the Nathan, He's going to give you a lot of warnings. And I'd say most of the time He makes sure we get the warnings first. But we've got to be careful and recognize that, well, just the danger that we present to ourselves a lot of time. And if the danger in ourselves is a danger to others also. Well, any other thoughts? We've got maybe 1 minute. So,
if that, you don't begin to sense God's displeasure and rewarding you when you do those things, wow. That's going to be your biggest fear, is that you have no remorse for.
Well, and that's part of the reason why we have to keep drawing near to Him. The closer we are to Him, or the closer that we seek to be to Him, the better we're going to be able to recognize those things and be able to understand, be able to hear. Greg?
Well, just my thought on it is, of course, I don't think it's the point of your
Spirit moves in many ways.
And also not to confuse the way of salvation with sanctification.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and it's been a major. We can maybe talk about that a little bit more next week. But that's a huge issue in church history. Oh,
right. I'm just going to say an analogy might be like learning to drive a car. You learn to drive, you can steer it, you can press the gas pedal, the brake pedal, and you know how to make a turn and that kind of thing. But if you don't drive defensively, you're going to get in serious trouble at some point. And it's not just defensively against someone else; it's defensively knowing that you can make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So the warning is to, okay, you know Christ, but now live like you.
It's a great analogy. It's terrible to hurt yourself, but I think even worse than to hurt somebody else, or to know that your carelessness led to someone else being. I think that's even, and so that we have to recognize that we have, again, this, we're a danger to ourselves, and we're a potential danger to each other.